Welcome to another edition of Metanoia. I'm your host, Junius Ricardo Stanton, and it's a pleasure to have a very dear friend of mine, Glenn Ellis Sr. Glenn is an author. He's a radio program host. He's a columnist. He's a syndicated writer, a lecturer, a health and wellness educator, and he specializes in health, equity, and ethics. And he's a consultant, and he's a certified healthcare ethicist from the Institute of Clinical Bioethics at St. Joseph University in Philadelphia, as well as he has a master's degree in public health from the University of Liverpool. Welcome, Glenn. Good to see you.
My brother, I was wondering who you were talking about. Couldn't have been me. Man, it's so good to go. So good to see you, and you're looking great, man. I'm really grateful to see you looking so good and healthy.
Yeah, you too, man. You looking real good. Look like you lost a little weight, and
that's it's called poverty. Like, it's poverty.
Yeah, it looked like back in the 90s, man, when we first saw each other every week.
Actually, it was actually the late 80s, my brother.
We would see each other at the radio station every week.
I thought that was 88, 89 for some reason.
I started in 90.
Okay. So I may have been there a year. I don't know. But either way, that's a long time ago,
yeah,
right?
Man. Yeah.
But anyway,
we go way
good
back.
For you. Hey, man, before we get started, I just wanted to acknowledge the enormously important work that you have committed your life to. And whether it was a conscious decision or not, you have committed your life to documenting great information and history. And you have benefited so many of us. All of us have grown because of the kind of work, you know, you've just been spreading these seeds and putting information out. And I just want to thank you on behalf of myself on a personal level, selfishly, because I've gained and learned so much from just listening to a lot of the interviews and a lot of the documentary radio program audio you've done. And it's just an enormous resource, you know, for the world community that you do this work and you committed your life. You could have been any number of things, from Lester Holt to Ted Cobb. I mean, you could have gone into another direction and had any number of options, but you chose to make sure you provided good, credible information to our basic communities around this globe. And for that, we thank you, brother.
Well, you're welcome. But like you said, I really didn't have a choice. This is a divine assignment. So I've accepted it, and we're doing this together. We've been working together on so many things over so many years. And we know that it's not about a paycheck. It's not about accolades, it's not about aggrandizement or anything like that. It's about fulfilling the reason we came here.
Yeah.
So I invited you to be on Metanoia, and Metanoia is a word that you find in, it's a Greek word you find in the New Testament. It really means transformation, renewing your mind. It's the root word for repent. And repent means really to change your mind, change how you think, change your orientation, and change your life. And you've been on a mission yourself to encourage people to change and transform. And so I will be ever grateful for you and to you for what you're doing. So rather than get caught up in this mutual aberration thing, we want to start by talking about something that you know very well. We're facing a health crisis in this country that predates the pandemic. And I would ask you to give an overview of the health system, quote unquote, and talk about that, talk about how these challenges impact us on a daily basis, whether or not we come into a healthcare facility or not?
That's an excellent question. And as I ponder how to frame my answer, I want to just take a quick second, and I want to really acknowledge, because it reminded me of the people in my life who have been instrumental in helping me to do this work. And at the top of that list is Dr. Reuben Warren, who is the director of the National Bioethics Center at Tuskegee University, where I am a visiting scholar under his leadership. And Dr. Warren has been instrumental to help me to look at my, through the lens through which I'm looking at this whole system. And one of the most fundamental points that has to be acknowledged about this, the answer to the question, is that the United States is the only country in the entire developed world whose healthcare system is tied to the free market. On the surface of it, that sounds pretty, you know, blasé. But what that means is, and not, that's the word. See, that's why I envy you, because you got that vocabulary, my brother. But listen, that is at the core of it, because everything that relates to critical decisions in healthcare, in medicine, in life and death, in treatments, and all of those things, all of those decisions have to first consider the economic impact on the bottom line. So we're a nation where, unlike other parts of the world, people are make medical decisions and they will say things like, he needs to get this particular procedure, but it's not covered under his insurance. So we're not even a nation that's capable, based on how our system is structured, of making good medical healthcare decisions in the best interest of the patient. We have to think about the bottom line. And if you start from there, everything else makes sense about the dysfunctional, fragmented nature of our healthcare system. And by fragmented, what I mean is the United States healthcare system. If you've got a football team and you wanted to make an organizational chart, you could make a flow chart to show who's where and how everything fits into the organization. You cannot put the United States of America's healthcare system on a flow chart because it's fragmented. I can't go to the doctor anywhere in the United Kingdom or in France or in Germany or in Italy or in Spain or in Canada without it being recognized and documented as a part of the healthcare system. If I live way out in the rural part of the United Kingdom and I went to London for a festival and got sick, they would know who my doctor is because they have a national healthcare system. Here, I could have five different primary care doctors in the United States and none of them would know each other. I could go to each one of them and get five different kinds of medications for the same thing. And if I was
Now, I was going to say, has that been addressed? Because what we're seeing now is the consolidation of these giant healthcare systems and this whole, what I call processization, where you're in a system, they keep your records, but is it moving toward that or is it still fragmented?
It's not moving toward that. What you just described is just the nature of competition in business.
Okay, right.
That's why Amazon owns Whole Foods. That's why Apple owns the companies that make every part of their phones all over the world. So because you continue to grow. We just in Philadelphia just had a situation that most people don't even realize just took place. Jefferson University now owns 18 hospitals in the Philadelphia region.
Well, in New Jersey. They just got
full control of Einstein Hospital. And they just bought the remaining control of Health Partners Medicaid plan.
Mm, okay. Okay.
So now the people who work at Einstein, the doctors, nurses, bedpan emptiers, all work for Jefferson. So Jefferson negotiates their salaries. Then the doctors who practice send their bills to health partners. Jefferson decides what the reimbursement rate is going to be. So you got to look at what this mergers and all these conglomerates mean.
The fact that they're doing that
has nothing to do with them moving in a direction that makes equity more reasonable and possible. In fact, let me just add this.
Okay.
I just want to add, you know, we just opened the Black doctors, COVID-19, opened their own clinic or medical center.
Right.
And there are two things that we cannot miss in that point. The first is, why is Dr. Ayla Stanford a hero? Why, in the most powerful, wealthiest country in the world, do the citizens of one of its major cities have to rely on volunteer doctors doing testing and screenings and giving vaccines in church parking lots? Does the rest of the city have to rely on that to get its healthcare during the pandemic? No, only certain segments of the population. So we have to question a system that's that broken that there can be an entire segment of a city's population that is not in the middle of a pandemic, probably the worst in history, in modern history, and this, a segment of the population can't get tested, can't get vaccines, unless some people volunteer to do that on the side. So I'm saying this is another example of how broken that system, when you asked that earlier question about the system. And so I'm just pointing out, giving you example after example. And now that that center is open, how is it going to survive financially? Because it ain't going to survive based on the kindness and the goodwill that went into it opening, that was behind the sentiment of people deciding to open it. It's got to operate off of the business model. And in business and healthcare, you got to have a payer mix, P-A-Y-O-R. So that population, the demographic where that place is located is 100% Medicaid. And if you talk about nursing homes.
And welfare.
Which means no, or maybe no insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a payer mix that has enough people with private insurance, enough people with Medicare, and enough people with Medicaid split out in the right proportions to make it possible so that there's an economic business model that's sustainable to keep the place open.
Okay. Now, so you've been championing for years to resolve the issue that Philadelphia had one of the highest infant mortality rates in the country.
It still does.
How does that fit into what you're talking about?
It's all interrelated. If the pandemic demonstrated that kind of deficiency in the city's healthcare system, and that was reflected all, it was repeated all over the country. We saw the same thing happen in other cities. But if that was reflected in a pandemic, then you gotta assume and expect that the system on an ongoing basis has those same shortcomings for certain populations. And in that case, as you mentioned, that happens to do with infant mortality, and particularly in Black community. But here's HIV/AIDS is another one. A lot of people don't even realize that in HIV/AIDS has basically now nationally become what's considered a chronic condition. And that's in the category of things like high blood pressure, diabetes. If you get the proper medication, you can live a full normal life. However, in Philadelphia right now, HIV/AIDS in the Black and Latino community is still an epidemic.
It's a comorbidity that has to be factored into all these other things. And I had a list, and we'll get to it, the top 10, you know, heart disease, cancer, chronic lower respiratory diseases, iatrogenic, unintended injuries, stroke, Alzheimer's, diabetes, influenza, pneumonia, kidney disease, and lo and behold, suicide. So yeah, we're looking at a system in a country that is, you know, you're saying the system is broken, and I'm saying that this country has been so traumatized that you're seeing a rise in suicides and you're seeing a decline in the life expectancy across the board. So in this environment, what can we do? What information do we need to have so that we can live full, functionally healthy and holistic lives?
Okay, that's a layer question, answer for that question. The first layer is to make sure that what we need to do is we need to understand how our bodies work and what our bodies need to work properly. I did a talk the other day and I was just reminding people that we have relinquished the control of our own bodies over to the healthcare system. See, we're sack two or three generations into the conditioning that all we do is say, you know what? I just don't feel good today. I'm going to the doctor to find out what's wrong. We've totally disconnected ourselves from the ability to be able to say, I feel nauseous. I ate that, got up in the middle of the night, and I know that was wrong. I shouldn't have eaten that. I know that was bad. It had been in the refrigerator. So I probably, you know, so we don't even think through
right,
that stuff.
Right.
So now what you're doing is you relinquish the power and the ability to control that. And you turn it over to your healthcare professionals, which is appropriate on some level. However, but you now got to hope they get it right. You're going to take whatever they say, you know what? You're okay. You just got a little heartburn. That's all. You might have salmonella poisoning, because you don't know enough about how your body works, so you can't even communicate exactly what's going on. All you can say is, I don't know, my stomach just bothering me. You can't even say I got cramps, or I feel like there's a sharp pain, or I feel this, or, you know, so we can't even get but so descriptive about our body. But I guarantee you, buy a new car, and tell somebody you bought a new car, and they say, well, what kind did you get? You'll tell them what color the seats are. You'll tell them they got power windows. You'll tell them about it comes with a Sirius radio. You'll tell them all of the features. So we can describe, it's got a V8 engine and, you know, it's got a differential rear end axle. Mm-hmm. So we can go into all of that, but we have allowed ourselves to be conditioned to let go of the most valuable thing we have, which is us, our bodies. So that's the first thing. We gotta say, not only how does it work, what does it need to operate at optimum levels? I wish I had a penny over the years for how many times people have said to me, I just don't like to drink water. I don't like water. What else can I drink? Right? Most plentiful substance on the earth. Our bodies are in an exact replica of the composition of the earth. 3/4 of the earth is water, us two. And we don't like to drink water. So I'm saying this is all conditioning. So in order, what we got to do, we got to realize the extent to which we're broken, all of us. And that's right. That's why Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk had a truth and reconciliation process. So we got to acknowledge how broken we are as individual people. We got to realize how broken our healthcare system is. And you know, as well as a lot of my close friends, you know, I teach in Cuba for years, for 12, 13 years, I teach bioethics. And when I look at how broken it is, it's magnified when I look at 75% of the doctors in Cuba are primary care doctors. 75% of our doctors in the U.S. are specialists.
Right.
Mm. Right. Now, I don't want to go too deep into politics, but I want to say this. I got personal friends who are as close to me in Cuba as you and I are, that are brain surgeons, literally. They make $100 a month. And they knew that's the most they would make from the time they decided they wanted to be a doctor. So you were talking about a nation of doctors who wanted to be doctors just to be doctors versus a nation of doctors who look at that as a pathway to affluence.
Right.
And a quality of lifestyle and all of those things.
Or because they have a family tradition and their parents and grandparents said, you're going to be a doctor.
And it all ties to money, though. Mm-hmm. So once again, we don't, because money is tied to our healthcare system, it contaminates the integrity of the system and prevents good outcomes.
A lot of things that you're talking about in summary can be seen in this book. This is one of your books called Information is the Best. Yeah, information is the best medicine. And you talk about
it.
And that's why I wanted someone like you to be on the program to help facilitate this transformation. We can't continue to go down this road where, and one of the things you say in the book, it is impossible to be healthy in America. And you talk about health literacy. So what you just talked about is us being disconnected from our bodies. That's part of health literacy. So how do we make the reconnection to our bodies, reconnect to those things that we need to do to maintain optimal health, not just barely getting by, I'm talking about to get on the road toward optimal health.
Well, I mean, in a nutshell, information is the best medicine, right? So, you know, I'm thinking about when I was in the third grade, Rick, there were a couple guys that were in my class. They were twins. They were fraternal twins, Bobby and Billy Dale. And we went to the candy store one day walking and we were passed by. We went in and they went in and they bought some peppermint sticks or something. And I didn't have any money I wasn't like I had a job or something. They just happened to have some nickel or a quarter or whatever. And I asked them, I said, hey man, can I borrow a nickel and I'll pay you back when I get my wallet? I truly believe that when you became an adult, there was a ceremony and they give you a wallet with money in it. And they give you a key ring with keys on it, because that's all I saw. All the adults, every adult I knew had a wallet. They had money in it and every one of them had keys. So I thought that was some kind of rites of passage I remember this guy, Bobby, gave me the nickel because he believed it just as strongly as I did. And then from third grade all the way on, finished high school. By the time I knew what credit was, I ain't have none. I didn't have any credit literacy. I didn't have any financial literacy.
Right.
So now you spend your rest of your life compensating, you know, putting your light bill in your mom's name and getting your sister to co-sign for your car. And you give her an extra $20 a month for gas for doing it. So you got to do all of these things to compensate. Rick, the same thing happens with our healthcare throughout life. We don't have health literacy. We're not given it as we go through different stages. Ain't nobody ever came with me in the bathroom while I was being potty trained. They were more concerned to see if I'm able to get my pants down before I make a mess, right? Mm-hmm. They're not trying to make sure I also use that opportunity to learn how to pay attention to my bowel habits and my bowel health. Am I passing healthy stools? Is there blood? Am I able to detect when there's blood in my stools? These are all the missed opportunities that we just grow up into life and we're just raised to become consumers. Not educated consumers, just consumers. Other people will decide what you want. They'll decide what kind of car is the one that the right one for you by the commercial. They waited to do the commercial. They'll decide where you go to get fast food by the emotional touchy-feely thing they put into the commercial at the fast food place. The doctor will decide what's wrong with you because you relinquish that also. So I'm just saying, you got to look at the across the board as a society where we are in order to understand what we have to start unfixing. So you got to go back and say, well, what do you insert in a child's growth, development, and education from the time I was in the third grade thinking that everybody got a wallet? What do you insert in the educational process at home, at school, in the community to make sure you're reinforcing health education messages? I was so sick and tired in 2020 to hear people talking about, you got to follow the science. You can't listen to him. You can't listen to them. Don't nobody in this country even know science. You can't follow what you don't know.
Right, right.
And so because we have such an arrogant, egotistical nature, particularly as Americans, nobody wanted to acknowledge and nobody wanted to say, oh, excuse me, I don't know anything about science. I'd never learned. Nobody ever taught me science. I don't know how to follow. But everybody was like, yeah, you need to follow the science. They don't want nobody know. Everybody was just, you know, just acting like they got it. But didn't nobody know? And it went on so long. So now here we are at a point where don't nobody really know what's going on.
Well, but I think one of the problems with that scenario is the science, quote unquote, has been monetized and weaponized. And so what we're seeing is people like yourself have been put on the shelf, some suppressed and censored because some of the things you say don't reflect well on the bottom line of the system. So that information is not getting out, but neither is a lot of other information that we need to have, such as nutrition, such as the importance of what you eat, the type of drugs and pharmaceuticals that you take in terms of your makeup. And there's a whole branch of science about that now. And we're totally ignorant of that. And so we're hurt and we're damaged because of our own ignorance.
Well, you know, and I just think that we have to realize the extent to which, I mean, I'm sitting here, I was listening to your last comment and I realized it made me remember that most Western countries won't, and most countries won't allow you to put commercials on for like canned sugar for kids and have cartoon animals and trying to sell sugary cereal. So you got, I'm saying this is a systemic problem.
Right.
Anytime I see a McDonald's commercial with a father and a son sitting there in this warm moment and they're trying to get into my emotions. And so now my son, little boy, is going to think that that's a way to show that I love him. Dad, take me to McDonald's and show me you love me. So you see, we're letting other people infuse into our consciousness to satisfy their goals at our expense.
Right. And we also are dealing with what they call regulatory capture, what I call agency capture, where you have a government agency like the FDA that's supposed to look out for and make sure that there are healthy, non-lethal products in the marketplace. But you see what we're getting. You see the food processing plants, you see the pharmaceuticals, and we're just not aware of how they have fallen captive to the pharmaceutical companies and the food processing plants and the conglomerates. And so the policies, the so-called public health policies, have been compromised. And now we can't trust the government. But we shouldn't at this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and like I said, I mean, that's a part of the broader narrative that needs to take place in a conversation like this, because the healthcare system is a part of the United States system. And there's some interconnectivity there. So you can't look at a complete system in this country without looking at the relationship and the influences with the other industries. You can't look at the let me give you a classic example. COVID vaccine, the Pfizer mRNA vaccine. Mm-hmm. It had to be stored at -90 degrees Celsius. They don't even have refrigeration like that, right? So now you got to create a complete different infrastructure just to get that stuff from where it's being made, transported across the country to all these different places where it's being distributed, unloaded, and then further distributed in the local area. And at every stop along the way, from start to finish, you got to have refrigeration to keep stuff that cold. Mm-hmm. So you can't talk about the healthcare industry in that regard until you talk about what kind of integrity and what kind of soundness do we have with the trucking industry.
Right.
And how can we even make this stuff? Because how are we going to get it? All the ingredients here. So I'm just saying you can't even say we're going to fix the healthcare system until you say, we got to look at these other connecting parts that may be interfering and preventing us from fixing it, or that even if we fix it, we won't be able to get a result because we didn't fix this part of that system. Mm-hmm. So until and unless, and here's the thing, we can't go in and say, how do we fix the healthcare system? What we have to do is say, how do we reposition people at the center of why all of this stuff exists instead of the other way around? All of these systems are existing to support our ability as people and humans to thrive on this planet. Instead, what we have done is allow industries and systems to be created that are kind of like the plant Audrey in Little Shop of Horrors, right? The more it grows, the more it's going to want to eat you. Mm-hmm. All it knows is feed me. So we've created these industries that just need to be fed. And after a while, the guy who kept giving the little plant eating that needed some blood, he had to stand there and prick his finger and let the plant, because the plant just wanted to keep eating and keep growing and getting bigger and bigger. Just like these conglomerates that you talked about. And the more they get bigger and bigger, the more they got to crunch those numbers and say, okay, we just built this whole new pavilion over here. We got to make sure 12,000 patients utilize this facility annually in order for us to break even. So now that influences the marketing campaign. Right. That influences the referrals of the doctors and their provider network. That influences the incentives that doctors get if they do certain kind of referrals or make people make sure they get certain screenings and all that kind of stuff. People don't know it. Just to give the COVID shot, Medicare was paying doctors $70 extra
right
as an incentive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should have added incentivized with the weaponization of the science and the monetization of the science, because
when you monetize something, it automatically becomes a weapon, because you have now given people an incentive to want to get that money. So that means whatever I got to do to get to that money, I'm gonna do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You say I need to see that goal in terms of, I got to see 50 patients a day. Because see, now most doctors are employees of the healthcare system. They're not the healthcare system take care of all the paperwork, all that. They pay them a salary, but they say, hey, Dr. Stan, I need you to see 50 patients a day. And so that means that doctor.
And if I spend
no quality.
If I spend over 15 to 20 minutes, and a lot of that is just inserting stuff into the computer, then I get called in to
the supervisor. Let me say this to you. I'm gonna correct you, brother. The data says that it's between 7 and 12 minutes.
Mm, okay.
That, and it's 7 minutes. when the doctor walks into the exam room, if he or she starts the conversation, you're going to be out of there in closer to 7 minutes. If you take charge, you can get the full 12 minutes. As soon as the doctor walked in, Doc, I couldn't wait to get here. I needed to see you today. Let me tell you what's going on. I got this, I got that. And so then you can control the time, the doctor. But if you walk in and the doctor gets the chance to say, what seems to be the problem today, Mr. Stanton? If he gets that, if he gets the jump, then he or she is going to control the time, because they know that there are four people waiting in exam, just sitting there waiting on them to walk in. So all they do is just, so that's the way they got to keep that quota going. So these are the kind of systems that we have in place that don't work for the best interests of patients. And so in order to, we got to recognize those deficiencies in order to know where do we go from here and how do we fix them? And I'm saying that starts with, how do we recognize the deficiencies?
Well, how do we get that message out? Because obviously when you look at the media, particularly over the air television and some of these cable channels, the pharmaceutical companies are the number one advertiser. And so that money controls policy, and that money and the policy is not going to allow too much criticism of that system.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing, man. This is what we're talking about are the kinds of movements that are going to be required. This is not going to be about an effort to change something. In the same way, I'm talking about these cross-sector systems that are interrelated, because now you got medical centers and hospital systems that have police forces the size of some towns.
Right.
You're talking about hospitals and medical centers that have environmental departments bigger than some cities' departments of environmental protection. You got same thing with, as it relates to a mobile fleet of trucks and cars for the place. So you can't start looking at how to fix the hospital system until you look at all the things that are connected to it, right? And so until we realize how pervasive all this is, that's why right now, one of the things that is really taking place in healthcare in this world right now is looking at it from a public health point of view and not looking at it from a medical point of view. Medicine is a part of public health.
Right.
And so the power in this whole equation is in the medical field. Right. And that's why right now they're trying to make the narrative all about everything in medicine. Because now you've heard that Merck has a pill that you could take, right, for COVID.
That's kind of like development, right? Yeah.
No. It's not. No. This is for real. Merck and Pfizer have them.
Yeah. Okay. So I've seen the fact that they're ready to roll it out. And when I said in development, I don't mean that they're still in the lab. I mean, they're getting ready to roll it out.
Right. And so here's the point. So now if they're ready to think about this, we're on a slippery slope with vaccines, because the reality says we might have to get a vaccine, a boost, some every 2 months. We don't know what that's going to look like. Now, you've heard of Tamiflu.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel like you're catching the flu, you could take Tamiflu and it like whips that stuff in half, eliminates the severity, the duration of the symptoms, and you're good. So that's what these pills do with COVID. So can you explain to me, why is it all of our human and financial resources went into developing something like going to the vaccine instead of developing a comparable product to Tamiflu? Because as we all know, the vaccines are not designed to keep you from getting infected.
Right. Well,
so if that's the case, then we need to, and 60 to 65% of the people who've been infected with COVID are asymptomatic. They don't even have symptoms.
Right.
So why are we still chasing a vaccine when that's not going to stop the infections from spreading?
I think it was a deliberate determination by people who had a vested interest in vaccines, because as you know, they have totally ignored natural immunity and the awesomeness of the human immune system. So it's all about the bottom line.
Oh, and that goes without saying. So I'm just saying, once again, our healthcare system is linked to the free market. So money decisions and business decisions will always override the practical matters of medicine and healthcare. We'll never get past that. We'll never be able to do that. And we'll never be able to fix it. Because in order to fix it, all of those 75% specialists we talked about, they got to be prepared to say, you know, $75,000 a year, I can live like everybody else.
Right.
You think that's going to happen?
Well, not if it's going to cost them a quarter million dollars to get that degree. No.
Which is a whole nother part of systems. Because Look at what that does. That's like a screen that keeps, make sure that only certain people can get through to the end.
Right.
You got the application fee. You got interviews. You got to take the MCATs. You got to pay for that test and study. Who got the resources? Who does them for free? Yeah. Who waives them? So that's why today, you know, we have literally, there are only 539 Black men in all the combined medical schools in the entire United States of America. That's it. 539.
Right. And so looking at that, what is the number and the percentage, say, of Indigenous people, Native Americans or Latinos? Is it less or on the same, on par?
Well, it's less, far less. In fact, right now, they say that, I got the data, I just did the presentation on this, on that part of our physician workforce, but combined, in terms of faculty at medical schools, combined with Black, Brown, Asian and Pacific Islander, Native American, and women, which would include white women, combined, they represent 4% of medical school faculties.
Wow. Yeah, okay. All right.
So there are not, I'm just saying, you gotta look at all of the mechanisms in place that are obstacles that will interfere. I just described, I thought you got a wallet with money in it when I was in the third grade. So if nobody inserted financial literacy in that, so where was the scientific literacy? I was fortunate that by the time I was in the fifth grade, I said, I'm gonna be a doctor. So I started being attracted to science before I finished elementary school. Mm. I was in the ninth grade. I couldn't wait to join the Future Scientists of America. I had a science project every year for the science fair in high school, right? So I'm just saying, so I was on a trajectory, and the teachers and the elders around me, they read that without me realizing it. They made sure I was doing what I needed to do, right? My mother told me before she passed that sometimes my teacher would call her and say, hey, listen, Glenn's got to do a speech tomorrow, or he's got to do a project or whatever, that the other boys aren't involved. They're not going to be on the program. Mm, mm. So when I go home from school and change my school clothes and put on my play clothes and go want to go out to play, you know, and I want to run out the back door and join my friends. And my mother says, hey, you got any homework? I was like, No, I'm done with the homework. I did it on my lunch period. She said, you don't have any programs, anything special, do you? I said, oh yeah, I got that thing tomorrow. I got to rehearse that speech I got to make. So the teachers would make sure I wouldn't
lunch
and get pulled away,
mm-hmm.
right? So I'm just saying, this is what is required for a pipeline. You see what the nature of public education is in the nation right now. You know what it was before the pandemic. So now the buildings were in disrepair, they were unhealthy, and now these kids got to go back under these conditions and blah, blah, blah. So it's not going to continue to improve. We just need to recognize how bad it is so that we can all be properly motivated to realize that it requires a broader movement. And by that, I'm sorry, go on.
Well, what can we do? Because a lot of people are not joiners. A lot of people are not leaders. You came from a community in Alabama where you saw leaders. You dealt with them. You had interaction with leaders. And you saw some people who chose not to be a part and parcel of that. You have chosen a path to be an initiator, to be a leader, to be a change agent. How do you encourage people who are not willing to take that step to take some steps to promote their own personal and familial health?
Well, you know, one thing is it all boils down to, on an individual level, who is it that you want to be as a human being? And then you got to ask yourself, what kind of world do I want to be a part of? Then you got to become the change. You got to be the thing you're trying to change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But also, all of that, none of that can happen if it doesn't come from a foundation of a sense of community, that you're part of a community. Because otherwise, it's easy to say, you know what? I can deal with it. My buddy's best friend is the head of the hospital over on the other side of town. If I ever need some medical stuff, he can hook me up. I don't even worry about it. So this disengages people from realizing that there's a collective interest here, that there is a community that we're a part of. Now, sadly, we lost community. We got places where there are large numbers of us living, but there's no sense of community. See, when I grew up, what you alluded to in Birmingham in the 60s, even if you didn't go to church, you didn't go out and play.
You're doing
on Sunday. You had to wait till church was out in the neighborhood. It didn't matter that you didn't go to church. And your family, which made sure didn't encourage you to want to go to become a church goer as a little kid, they respected the community.
Values, right. Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to have yellow paint to paint the curb parking spot to say reserved for pastor. Everybody know whose spot that was because it was respect for what's going on in your community. Now, granted, times have changed. Geographically, we ain't even around each other, but we still have to, in our conscious, have a sense of community. We don't even want to embrace that. Now, if we start that, because we can then appreciate that the life expectancy for a person who lives in Strawberry Mansion in North Philly is 20 years less than somebody who is 2 miles away in Center City. Just by your zip code.
Right.
20 years. So until we realize that this is a part of a system, so you're growing up living in the same city, drinking the same water, breathing the same air, but you live 20 years less. There's something else going on in the realm of the social determinants of health. Because here's what's critical. When you talk about how to change the healthcare system and why it's broken and all that, It's important. The research says that between 80 and 90% of your health outcome is determined by things that have nothing to do with the doctor. Clinical care only represents 10% of your health outcome and your health status, right? Your biology and genetics can represent up to another 10%. So that means between 10 and 20%. Now, you may have a genetic predisposition to diabetes, but you can actually do things with lifestyle modification to make that not even significant. So that's why I'm saying between 10 and 20% of your health is determined by clinical care and by your biology and your individual genetics. 80 to 90% ain't got nothing to do with the doctor or healthcare. It's about the conditions of where you live, the environment of where you live, what you breathe in when you go outside, your stress level, your educational level, your access to healthy foods, your knowledge of what healthy foods are. The social determinants are going to make that thing work. Not whether you got good insurance, but we live in a society where because of the integration of our healthcare system and the free market and Wall Street, we have told, everybody is made to believe that the most important thing is just to have insurance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that means that somebody somewhere is getting a premium every month on your behalf. People tell me, man, I'm so grateful for Obamacare because it just, I don't know what I, but what you don't, you're still paying for it. Your premium still costs $600. You're paying $50 because the federal government is taking your tax money and giving the insurance company the other $550.
Right.
And we think Obamacare has made a change in healthcare. It hasn't. We live in a society right now in the United States of America. The federal government is the largest purchaser of pharmaceutical drugs because of the Medicaid and Medicare programs. Nobody buys more drugs. So they're in the catbird seat in terms of leverage. Congress has a law. There's legislation that says it's against the law to negotiate the price that the pharmaceutical company comes to the government with. They said, this year those high blood pressure pills, last year they were $75 a piece. We thought this year we're going to charge $250. The government can't even negotiate. They got to pay whatever these people ask for. That's how broken our system is. So until and unless we're ready to have a movement to address the system. Now, the person who ain't want to get into the movement is a person who said, wait a minute, that's where my tax money is? They support that part of the movement.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There are people who see that their inadequacies in the admissions and the makeup of medical school population and enrollment, they can do that part of the movement. There are people who don't like that there are disproportionate numbers of poor and low income and people of color dying from this pandemic. They can support that part of the movement. And that's what I came out of the civil rights movement. Everybody wasn't marching. The crossing guard, they were in the movement to make sure that those children were safely going across the street. There were no cars that were swinging by to try to hurt some of these children and scare them. And the crossing guard would be ready to put their body in front of it. Mm-hmm. The crossing guard wasn't going down the march. So I'm saying we got to look at the dynamics of a movement. And it ain't about going to march and protest signs. That's a part of the movement.
Right. Well, I think you're in the forefront with your books giving information. So I have two copies of two of your books. One is Which Doctor? It's a play on words. It's a question. And then of course, the information is the best medicine. So how can people get copies of your books?
Well, you know, I have a lot of my information that we've talked about, a lot of resources, they could go to my website, which is glennellis.com. And Glenn is spelled with two N's, glennellis.com. And I do a lot of posting on social media about this information. So they can go to follow me on Twitter or on Facebook to really get access. So I try to stay as current and as credible with the factual information that I've come out and provide.
Now, you're a writer. You write locally for the Philadelphia Tribune, which is an African-American newspaper. You're on WURD, but you also are a frequent guest on many other national or regional programs. So how can people find out more information about what you're doing?
I was listening to you, and I was like, man, everything's happening in real time. So I was doing a weekly show on WURD. So the demands, I just can't do everything, right? So what I do now, I do radio commentary locally on iHeart in Philadelphia. Through Patty Jackson's show. I do Stevie Wonder Station, KJLH out in LA. I do WBON with Chat Daddy out in Chicago, GBH in Boston, Birmingham. So, and Shreveport, Louisiana. Bishop has an enormous radio and television that covers the state of Louisiana and parts of Texas. So I just make sure that I put it out as much as possible. And the Tribune column actually went into a nationally syndicated through the Black Press through with Hazel Edney Trice's media. And I had to kind of pull back on that, but I did just write a piece for her to syndicate that was about Colin Powell's passing, just to put more information around it, to talk about the multiple myeloma, to talk about where he was. He was fully vaccinated. Although with multiple myeloma, the data shows that you have to get that booster. He was scheduled to get the booster the following week, but didn't make it. So it's a lot of those kinds of things, right? That we have to make sure we get the information out. And we've been so information starved. You know, throughout this interview several times, you said, where do people, because we are starved. We don't have good sources of credible, trusted information. And so I've done everything I could with my life, just as you've done with yours, to make sure that I have been a vessel to make sure that I can channel good, credible information that we can trust, that speaks directly to who we all are as people.
And that's critical, because our community is most at risk. And I think, you know, the brokenness of the system does not bode well for us as we go forward. Because, you know, most of the people who, you know, even the CDC said that most of the deaths from COVID were mainly associated with comorbidities, not so much COVID itself. And so if we can get the comorbidities down and focus on optimal health, then we're better all the way around.
Well, but and one of the most critical things to deal with chronic conditions that are comorbidities in these situations is you've got to have the most critical component is primary health care. So think about this: during the pandemic, all of these populations that are rampant with comorbidities and more vulnerable during this pandemic, their communities didn't have primary care centers because they all closed down.
Right.
So that means we went a year and a half. Think about it: we went at least a year and a half with a significant number of people in the United States of America with chronic conditions who didn't get any primary care.
Right. So just
and those are progressive diseases and conditions. Right, so it's not like the thing says, okay, we know there's a pandemic. I'm high blood pressure. I'm diabetes. I'm not going to get worse until after this is over. And then you can go back and get your doctor. It can continue. And then you got to think about what were the behaviors of stress? What kind of bad diets?
Right.
Were there other kinds of behaviors? Were there alcohol, drugs because of the stress or the grief or any of this stuff that has further exacerbated? So I'm saying we are a long way from trying to be able to say that we can change this system. We are far, far away from it.
Right. And so if the rest of the country is like Philadelphia. So Hanneman closed down. Now St. Christopher's Children's Hospital is in financial trouble. So those are community. Hanneman was downtown. St. Christopher's is in the neighborhood. So that means that those people in that area are even at greater risk because the institution is facing financial difficulty. So there's only two children's hospitals in Philadelphia, Children CHOP and St. Christopher. So if St. Christopher goes under, you know, there's a whole segment of the city that will suffer.
And you know, it's just the same soup warmed over, because that was repeated when Mercy Douglas closed. It was repeated when PGH closed.
Now it's repeated,
you know, Hahnemann's closed. And, you know, so it's just a lot, you know, there were 34 hospitals that closed in Philadelphia. I think 34 that closed just during the 70s. They used to be Germantown Hospital, Northeast Hospital, Frankfurt Hospital, there were hospitals everywhere. West Park Hospital.
Yeah, Roxborough Hospital. Yeah.
Roxborough. So I'm just saying, you got to look. They're all gone. So, and that will be okay, because hospitals are places for sick people. Now, it will be okay, but we are a society of people that has been accustomed that we don't know how to take care of ourselves. We have to go to the hospital to even know how to be taken care of.
Right. And then you don't get the full information or the regimen, or there is almost really no incentive for you to be well. If truth be told, there's really no
as many experts will say, we don't have a healthcare system. We have a sick care system.
Yeah.
The financial incentive is in people being sick.
Right.
Not in people being healthy.
Right.
The business model is designed on people being sick. So all of this is about finance and the business model of medicine in the United States of America.
Right.
I've worked all over the last 30 years. I have been all over the world. Every country I named, from Canada, France, Germany, Belgium, Germany, England, Africa, Cuba, Latin America, Central America, South America. I know how these health systems work. Mm-hmm. Nobody else would do that.
Yeah.
Nobody else would do that.
Yeah.
And nobody else would be trying to figure out ways not to help do their part to protect the public.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing, is figuring out how not to do our part.
Well, the challenge here is my goal is to get as many people as possible to become aware of the need to change, because
that's all we're on the same mission, brother.
Right. As they say, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again with the same people, expecting the thing.
And expecting something going to be different.
Right. Okay. All right, brother. I appreciate you taking time out.
Man, I appreciate you, man. I really appreciate you, my brother. Thank you. You sent me a text. Hey, let me say this. When you sent me a text, I say, man, listen, I don't care what it is. If it's you let me know what it is you want me to do.
Okay. And that's a bet. We're going to keep on keeping on. We're going to have you back.
Did you pay for them books, man? Because I was just going through the records here. I don't see no receipt.
I can't.
Are you sure they're your books?
No, I can't. I know. You signed them.
You sure did. You came to both of them, bro.
Yeah. Now, we've been supporting each other.
Yes, sir.
And
let me just tell you this. I am enormously, I don't know how the people who are watching this will receive this. I am enormously grateful to be on the planet at the same time you are, bro.
Well, the feeling is
mutual. I can't imagine being on the planet trying to do what I'm doing and to not know that you're there doing what you do. And on the times when our paths cross, going in and out of radio stations, and you know what I mean? And
yeah,
it was like the changing of the guard. And it was just that just this the spirit and the energy and the and just that we exchange. And I know I got my benefit, my share of it from you. I don't know what I was giving you, but I always got something because you always represented a reminder of our ancestral obligations to do this work and not look for no rewards recognition and acknowledgement. That ain't what we're doing it for.
Right.
We're doing this because we want us all to be able to live on a better planet, in a better world, as better people, respecting who each other is or are, whatever the right term is. My boy, I got a teacher at Hills Elementary School. She slay me if she heard me split that verb like that.
No, but you know what? And I'll let you go. The energy on that segment, it was me, you, Dr. Morgan, just the energy.
Johnny Sample.
Yeah, no, but I'm talking about that Sunday segment that we were on, that Sunday night block that we had.
Okay, it was Dr. Morgan.
Yeah, but then they had...
Oh, Ron and Margo.
Yeah. They were earlier on, then they had the Masonic people on early afternoon. But I'm saying that evening block.
Oh, yeah, that was the joint. We had it rocking.
Yeah. All right, man. So how can people contact you other than the website?
Website? Well, my email at glennellis.com, info@glennellis.com, and that will be a way to make sure that you get in touch and make sure any kind of information I can provide, if it's reasonable or whatever, I'd be happy to respond. And but more importantly, I think you'll find a wealth of information that I post. I mean, I've taken that as a personal obligation and responsibility to make sure that in this day and age where social media has that relevance, somebody's voice, and I'm not saying I'm the only one in the world, but I'm making sure my voice is going to make sure that there's credible information.
Okay, brother. Appreciate it. Thank you. Love you, man.
Love you as much, man. All the best. Tell Queen Sonia I said hello to, would you please?
All right. And tell your wonderful children, Jasmine and your son, that I admire them. They just turned out so well, man. And they're a credit to your family, man.
Who are these people? I don't know who they are now. You know, Jasmine is a senior producer now. She left ESPN and she's now at CNN. And my son is a vegan chef for the Eagles and the Sixers.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay. So he's still in the area. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you probably, listen, you remember that kid, I would never eat, he couldn't make me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich when he was growing up. I was like, I'm not touching that. But now I was like, wow, man. So that's the hope that for the future that we all benefit from. You know what I mean?
Right. Yep. All right, man. Stay well.
Thank you so much.
We'll be talking to you. Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it.